Well, good morning, everybody. It does my heart good to hear you all visiting and talking this morning, because we're going to be talking about relationships today, so I'm very excited about that. So I'm Jason. I am one of the deacons here at the church, and as I just said, I'm going to be talking about relationships today, specifically the idea of relational intentionality. We've been working on this series called Transformational Church, where we are looking at factors that seem to influence how we do church, how people are transformed and changed because of things that we might do here in a church. God works through people, but he works through his church as well. And so for a number of weeks, we're going to be looking at different variables that might show some influence on how we might be transformed. And before we kick off here, I want to go ahead and pray. Lord God, I thank you for the chance to be here this morning. I thank you for each and every person gathered under this roof. God, I pray that as I speak today that you would challenge each of us to consider the importance of relationship. God, you value relationships and created us that way. And I pray that as I speak that not only myself, but those who are hearing would be transformed by your word. God, I pray that your spirit would be upon this place. I pray this in your name. Amen. So again, my topic is relational intentionality, and I'm not really sure how I got picked to do this. I think Pastor Dave and I were talking and thought that it might be a good fit for me, but I suspect one reason is because I'm a psychologist by training, so I'm supposed to be really good at relationships. I'm supposed to be able to know how relationships work. And then I think the other side is I'm actually in a lot of relationships. I'm in a marriage, and I have kids, so I'm a husband and a father and a son and a friend, and I go to church here, so I'm a church member. So I'm in a lot of relationships as well. So those things give me kind of some fodder or something to draw upon as I think about relationships. But even mentioning those things, I think that I'm often not really good about being intentional in relationships. For example, I'm the kind of guy who thinks I really should call this person over here and see if they want to get together and have breakfast, and then I don't. In fact, one of the edgers who's sitting up here and I were talking last week, and he said, you know, when you and I first met, I contacted you a couple times about getting together, and we didn't. And that was my fault, because I didn't kind of follow up and pursue that. And so there's a lot of times when I'm just frankly not very good about being intentional in relationships. And so I hope this is a learning process for all of you, as it's really been a learning process for me as we think about this. You know, I want to look at the importance of relationships both inside the church, outside, but I guess primarily inside, and see kind of how we really think through this. This series that we're doing is based upon a book called Transformational Church, which was based upon a large research study. But more important than what that book found is I think God's Word talks about the importance of relationship, and that's really where we need to be grounding ourselves. So, what is relational intentionality? I think the first thing that we would think is that relational intentionality has to do with relationships. So, being with other people. You know, churches who are relational value people. They value the people who come through the doors and spending time with one another more than just sitting next to somebody on a Sunday morning. We want to be able to grow more deeply, to live life or share life together. But then there's this intentional piece as well. And this is, I think, something maybe we think about less often. And this is the idea that in relationship, we need to be intentional about discipleship. We know in the Great Commission, we're called to make disciples. And so part of that is, as we interact with one another, to grow more deeply in our relationship with God and with one another. And so there's both components that make up this idea of relational intentionality. You know, I think one of the things I would kind of point to is that God created us to be in relationship. Last weekend, I was in Branson, Missouri. I was asked to come down there and do a short talk. I was asked to come down and respond to a couple of authors who were there. And one of the guys who spoke was a guy named Kurt Thompson, who wrote a book called Anatomy of the Soul. And it's a book about interpersonal neurobiology. So I had to respond to this idea of interpersonal neurobiology. And his basic idea, and I think he's right, is that when God created us, he not only created our brains to run our bodies individually, I mean, he created them to run my thoughts and my emotions and my movements and all of that sort of thing, but God created our brains in such a way that they work together with other people as well. He really showed that in the brains of people that when I speak to someone, when I speak to Nichelle, for example, her brain responds to me. It changes based on responding to me. My brain changes in response to her. And so there are these changes that actually take place. We change by the idea of being known by other people. And so God created us, even biologically, to be in relationship with one another. With that said, I think we live in a society that relationships have become less and less important. So, for example, you know, we have all of these wonderful technologies that are coming out, things like cell phone, television, automobile, Facebook, internet, instant messaging, all of these sorts of things that can provide a lot of really positive things. There's also some drawbacks that come with each of those. What happens a lot of times is someone may have 1,000 friends on Facebook, and each of those relationships is an inch deep. They don't really know any of those people on any deep level. You get 100 text messages a day, and yet you still feel lonely. And this is happening more and more as technologies kind of proliferate. And people want to experience being known, and it's just not happening to the way that it used to, or certainly not the way that God designed us. So God created us for relationship, and yet a lot of people feel lonely. So what does the church do about that? I want to look at John 13 here for a minute, John 13, 34 and 35. Jesus is having the Last Supper with his disciples, and he is talking with them. They've just finished supper. Judas is left, and the other 11 remain. And he says to them, starting in verse 34, he says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." So he doesn't say, "A new commandment I give to you, make sure you get the law perfect so you can follow it exactly." He doesn't say to them, "Make sure you have perfect worship music so the people who come through your doors are really going to be drawn and excited by the music." He doesn't say, "Make sure you get your theology perfect." What he says is "Love one another just as I've loved you. So you are to love one another." Okay, so how do we love one another like Jesus loved us? And how's that? I think kind of looking at the concept for today, we do that with relational intentionality. And what I want to do for the rest of the time is look at a few things that these authors who wrote this book talk about. They kind of mention four different things that work to promote relational intentionality. And so we're going to look at each of these specifically with reference to Jesus' life because, I mean, he's really good at this. I mean, he was the perfect man at each of these things. So we're going to look at his life with each of these variables. So the first thing, relationally intentional environments produce family. In other words, we foster relationships at a much deeper level than just sitting next to one another on a Sunday morning. We do life together. You know, just think of the ways in which Jesus interacted with his disciples. He called them his brothers. He called them his family. He repeatedly refers to people in family terms. And I think one of the things that strikes me about Jesus is that he was someone who shared the good and the bad that was going on in his life with them, as a family should. There wasn't an impression management. He really showed himself to other people. So again, thinking of this idea of good and bad, I want to look at briefly at two short parts here that he shared his life with. The first is the Transfiguration, which is in Matthew 17. We're not going to spend time reading through this, but I kind of want to talk about a few aspects of this. Basically, what happened is Jesus, again, spent so much time with his disciples, and in this one event, he invites his disciples, three of them, Peter, James, and John, to go with him up this mountain. And so they go up this high mountain. The disciples don't really know why they're going, but they follow Jesus because that's what they do. I mean, they follow their teacher. And so they go on up this mountain, and they get to the top, and they don't know what they're there for. You know, if it was me, I'm sure I would be thinking, oh, finally here I can sit down. But they're just following and waiting. And all of a sudden, Jesus turns bright white, and they're pretty amazed because they're seeing something that nobody at that time had ever really seen. They're seeing a glorified Jesus. I mean, what an amazing thing to be able to see that. And not only that, they get a chance to see Moses and Elijah as well. But it doesn't stop there. What we next read is that God then speaks. They audibly hear God's voice. And just like I would hope would happen with every one of us, they fall flat on their face. I mean, they're terrified in hearing his voice. And so they lay there and they don't move. But then Jesus comes and taps them on the shoulder and tells them not to be afraid, but to rise and follow him. And it doesn't say this necessarily, but I can just envision their conversation of Jesus saying to them, guys, that's what our dad sounds like. That's what his voice sounds like. That's what we get to look forward to. I want to share this great thing with you. I want to share this wonderful thing that's occurring and what we can all look forward to down the line. And can you imagine the questions that they had on that trip back down the mountain? I mean, I just think when I show my daughter Tessa, who's three, if I show her something really cool, she talks more than she normally does, and she talks a lot. And but they would have just been jabbering back and forth, and he would have just been smiling and answering their questions and just glad that he could share this wonderful experience with each one of them. But he also shared hard times with them. And I think we see that a few chapters later when he's in the Garden of Gethsemane. Yeah, this follows right after the Lord's Supper. And so according to Luke's account of the Last Supper, Jesus says to them right before the meal that he earnestly desired to eat the Passover meal with them before he suffered. Can you imagine how they would have felt hearing those words? Here's a man who has a lot on his plate. He's about to be crucified. He knows that he's going to be forsaken by God here shortly. There are a lot of people who want his attention. And he takes these 12 and he says to them, guys, I'm eager to eat this meal with you. I want to be with you right now. There's nowhere I would rather be for the next couple of hours than spending this meal with you guys. I mean, that would have just provided a lot of encouragement, a lot of made these guys feel just really wonderful to be experiencing that. And so they eat the meal together, and they finish up, and they sing a hymn, and then they go out for a walk, and they go to the Mount of Olives. And they go along the way, and a couple of them Jesus asks to sit down, but he takes Peter, James, and John, same three from the Transfiguration, takes Peter, James, and John on with him for a little while. Jesus' mood is going to be much heavier. He knows what's coming. He knows he's going to be forsaken by God. And yet he brings these three along with him. And they go along the way, and Jesus stops and he says to them, my soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me. So he's saying to these guys, almost, I'm so sad. I wish I could just depart right now and go and be with God, but I can't. So I want you to stay here with me while I go off and pray for a little while and go talk with God. And you know the story. Jesus prays in anguish and the disciples fall asleep, and this happens a couple of times, but Jesus wanted them along to see this really hard part of his life as well. And that's what families do. I mean, they share life together. Jesus, with his disciples, taught them and he fed them and he encouraged them and he built them up and he challenged them when they needed to be challenged. And, you know, they were his family and he was really intentional about letting them know everything that was going on with them. What would our churches look like today if we responded in the same way that Jesus would? What if we treated one another truly like family? You know, I think one of the things is I would hope we would share our joys and sorrows with each other. You know, I would think that Jesus, what we see demonstrated here is he would want us to really be in one another's lives. You know, can you imagine what it would be like if church was in such a way that when one guy was struggling with something, he could go to another brother in the church and say to him, you know, I'm really struggling with anger. And in fact, today before I came to church, I just screamed at my son and I feel ashamed and guilty. Can you pray for me? And the other man reminds him that in Christ he has forgiveness. And then they pray with one another. And they're encouraging and challenging to each other. Yeah, there's a few men in my life who are like that, who I can actually talk to and share with them kind of the rough spots, the rough patches, and the joys that are going on in my life. And I'm very blessed by those men. I consider them my brothers. And yet there are times when I find myself either wanting to hold back from sharing certain things because I want to kind of manage my image a little bit, or when they share something, I start to feel a little smug. I start to think, well, that's not a sin that I deal with. And yet, I'm being challenged to grow and learn in this because we're family. I want to be able to share everything that's going on with them. So understand here that we're family. Families really live and do life with one another. Families have a much deeper relationship than you might otherwise see in a lot of other relationships in life. And so I would encourage us to try and live to do the same. The second thing is that relationally intentional environments practice one-on-one relationships. And the authors make this point that corporate worship is important and small groups are really important. But one of the places where we see the most growth is through one-on-one types of relationships. And the Gospels are full of examples of Jesus speaking to people in a one-on-one basis. Sometimes he would challenge, sometimes he would rebuke, sometimes he would encourage, sometimes he would uplift, sometimes he would give the words of life. And for each of the people he would speak with, he would say exactly what people would need to hear. And I think of the 12 disciples. Surely he spoke to each of them in a one-on-one basis. But the one that I think we get the clearest picture of is with Peter. Jesus and Peter, you get to see a lot of that relationship. And at some point, I would challenge you to kind of work through the four Gospels and really look at the interaction between these two. Again, you get to see the good and the bad, the righteous and the ugly with the two of them going on. I mean, you see a lot. Peter's an encouragement to me because it gives me hope that God can really work with messy people. Peter is somebody who spoke what he thought. He was impulsive. He did and said things without thinking it through. He was, you know, so often doing things without really considering what came next. But his heart was also really dedicated to Jesus, which is an encouragement. You know, and so again, go through and look at each of the stories there. But the one I really like or want to focus on, one of my favorite stories in the Bible, is in John 21. This is right after Jesus had been raised from the dead. The disciples knew it. So this is that time before Jesus is ascended. And we come to John 21 and we find out that the disciples are gathered together on the beach and they go fishing and they catch nothing. And morning comes and Jesus is there standing on the beach and he says to them, "Have you any fish? Children, have you any fish?" And they say, "No," and they don't recognize Jesus. And he says, "Throw your net on the other side." So they throw the net over the other side and they get this huge haul of fish. And Peter, again, remember, he's impulsive, recognizes it's Jesus, he puts on his cloak and he jumps right in the water. I mean, he doesn't even wait to row in. He just goes, and he just goes to be with Jesus. He wants to be with this guy. And so they go and they have breakfast together. But then the next part is that we read of this conversation between Peter and Jesus. I suspect they're off walking on their own. And Jesus is talking to him, and he says to him, starting at verse 15, it says, "When they finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, 'Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?' He said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' He said to him, 'Feed my lambs.' He said to him a second time, 'Simon, son of John, do you love me?' He said to him, 'Yes, Lord, you know that I love you.' He said to him, 'Tend my sheep.' He said to him the third time, 'Simon, son of John, do you love me?' Peter was grieved because he had said to him the third time, 'Do you love me?' And he said to him, 'Lord, you know everything, and you know that I love you.' Jesus said to him, 'Feed my sheep.'" So they had gone on this walk, and I suspect what Peter was probably thinking before they left is, now the other shoe's going to drop. I've been outspoken throughout my time with Jesus, but I really messed up before he was crucified, because three times I denied him. Three times I said that I didn't know him. You know, I suspect what he was expecting to hear was Jesus saying to him, "Listen, Peter, I know that I told you that I was going to use you as the rock on which I was going to build my church, and plans have changed, because that whole denial of me thing, Peter, sort of showed me that you lack character. You don't have character, Peter, and we can't have men running the church who don't have character. And so I decided to go with John instead." But that's not what Peter hears. Peter hears three times Jesus asking him, "Do you love me?" Remember, Peter denied him three times. Three times Peter gives him a chance to back away from that, to say, "No, I love you, I love you, I love you." So he gives a chance to remind him of his grace, and he says exactly what Peter needs to hear in that circumstances. So Jesus is masterful in the one-on-one. He's masterful in large groups. You know, he loved people wherever they were at. What would our relationships look like if we did the same thing? How would we interact with one another? You know, we'd probably pray for one another. We would probably really be intentional about seeking out, encouraging, challenging one another, pushing one another to become disciples, to grow in our discipleship. My wife, Heather, is really good at the one-on-one. You know, I don't know that she thinks she is, but she's really good at the one-on-one. You know, there's several women that she ministers to, and I know there are times when I come home at night and the day's been a mess. The kids have just been pulling at the reins all day, disobeying. The house is a disaster. Dinner's not ready. And I can see the exhaustion when I come in the house. And then I probably add to it by how I respond. But then the phone will ring, and we have caller ID, so it shows who it is. So the phone will ring, and more often than not, Heather picks up the phone. And I get to listen to her encourage and love and challenge these women when she probably would really benefit from just going and taking a nap. You know, so she's really good at ministering in the one-on-one. And I get to watch that, and my kids get to watch that, and it's just such a blessing to us, and we get to see the fruit of that happening. In my life, Pastor Dave is one of those people. A few weeks ago, I was in Virginia for a training thing that I was going to out there, and I stopped in Dave's office, and I said, "Do you have a few minutes to talk?" And he said, "Come on in, sit down." So I came in, sat down, and I talked, and I talked, and I talked, and I talked. And I told him about everything I was learning and hearing, and I was just so excited and just sharing with him all of these things. And then I realized I had been there probably over an hour, and I was like, "Oh my goodness, I'm sorry that I have taken so much time." And he just, as an encourager, said to me, he said, "No, Jason, I was eager to hear those things. I was eager to hear what you wanted to share with me." And for me, that was a huge encouragement. Yeah, I think we all need people like Dave or like Heather in our lives who minister to us on a one-on-one basis, who can really pour into us and help us to be encouraged and to grow more deeply in our relationships with Christ. But I would also challenge each of us to try and be that type of person for others as well. You know, I think that so often we think, boy, there's still a lot of sin in my life, and I don't know the Bible very well, and my prayer life is a mess, and I just don't know if my theology is exactly right. People want to be in relationship. They want to be loved by others. So step out in those sorts of things. The third thing is that relationally intentional environments provide space for difficult people. You know, I think this is one that's probably more challenging for a lot of us. You know, when we think of churches, too often, if we're honest with ourselves, we think of places that are filled with people who are a lot like us, who are on their way to perfection. Just kidding. But are surrounded with people that we like to be around. It's sometimes hard, you know, to be around certain types of people. And yet, that's so too often, if we're honest with ourselves, what we think of church. You know, we don't think of church as a hospital. We think of it as a country club, as a place to come and hang out with friends, rather than a place for the sick and hurting. You know, Jesus didn't have a country club view. I mean, he always had eyes for difficult people. If you read the Gospels, he was surrounded by people who were possessed by demons and Pharisees and Sadducees and proud people and difficult people, and even his disciples were challenges, and yet he would pursue those people. You know, John 5 tells the story of this interaction that Jesus had with a man at Bethesda, which is a pool there. It was considered a healing pool. And we read in John 5 that at this place there would gather a multitude of invalids. It says blind, lame, and paralyzed, and they would lay there. And when the water was stirred up, they would bring these people down into the water. But the story isn't about Bethesda. It's about Jesus seeking out this one man that everybody else was ignoring. You know, this was a time when he could have been teaching. There was a festival going on at the time. He could have been teaching or rebuking or praying over the city, but he came and found this one person. There was a man there who, we read, had been an invalid for 38 years. I'm going to be 40 in a couple of weeks. So for me, the idea of this person had been an invalid for most of my life, I can't even imagine that. And this guy was rejected by people who were already at the bottom of society. People were stepping over him and ignoring him and casting him aside, just not paying attention to him. And so Jesus sees him and he asks him, he says, "Do you want to be healed?" And the man said, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, when I'm going another steps down before me." So life was a struggle for this guy. It had been for 38 years. He had been forced to live on the fringes of society. He was probably alone, no one to help him. And rather than lending a hand, most people would just brush him aside or step over him on their way. And he didn't really have a lot of hope of getting better. And yet Jesus, with a simple command, says, "Take your bed, get up and walk." So the man who was really had no hope now passed from sickness to health. You know, it would have been easy for Jesus to step over him. I'm sure this man wouldn't have thought anything of it because everybody else ignored him too. But Jesus didn't. He saw this man and he spoke to him. And we as Christians are called to do the same thing. Matthew 25:40 says, "Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of these least of these brothers of mine, you did it to me." You know, so I think we all have an obligation to be moving toward other people. Ed Welch, who's one of my favorite biblical counselors, wrote about this idea of moving toward people. You know, he talks about this idea that Jesus has a tendency to move toward sinners, to move toward difficult people. And in churches, in any community, there's going to be people who sometimes put up a sign that says, "Stay away from me. I don't want you to come near me. I may hand you your head if you get anywhere close." We have other people who seek our advice, seek our counsel, want to learn from us, and so we offer it, and then they ignore it, and then go on the next day and complain because their life is still terrible, even though they're not following this clearly biblical advice that, of course, we ourselves would follow. And it's so easy, it would be so easy to just tell ourselves, "I really want someone who's more like them to go and respond to that person. Or maybe when they get it better together a little bit, then I can go and talk to them. Or maybe when they're ready, they'll actually open up to me. But if we're to love like Christ loved us, we have to practice moving toward people. We have to practice drawing nearer to people who otherwise might make us feel a little bit more uncomfortable. You know, I think we have to get in the practice of seeing difficult people. I think between services, Mark Anderson and I were talking, and he said, you know, one of the questions to really be asking is, in your life, who do you consider to be the difficult people? When you think of coming to church, or when you think of going into certain community settings, or when you think of certain things, who are the people who you just think, ugh, I would rather stay on the other side of the street. I would rather not deal with this person. And that may be the growth edge for you. That may be the place where you can most benefit and change. And then to think about, in this, in 2012, who are the people who are so often cast aside? You know, again, I said I work as a psychologist, and I have opportunity to engage in a lot of different settings, not only in work, but outside of that as well. And I've gotten into this practice of thinking, when I meet somebody, would this person feel welcome coming to our church? And I can't say that I'm always proud of what the answer might be for that. And I want this to be a place where we can have people feel comfortable walking through our doors, where we can, where when they come in, they feel loved here. You know, Jesus was drawn to difficult people, and I would hope that we also would really work towards exploring for ourselves who are those people who we need to work on moving toward. How do we learn to extend patience to others? How do we learn to extend love to other people? How do we learn to point people again and again to Christ, who, as difficult people, showed us grace? And then the final point the authors brought up was this idea of relational, intentional environments have systems and processes. And I read this and I thought, yeah, I don't like the word systems and processes, in part because they suggest charts and graphs and that sort of thing to me, and they don't suggest relationship. And yet, the authors make the point that churches that have these systems and processes in place really can use them to foster relationships, foster being intentional about relationships. You know, one of the things that we have is, in corporate worship, we have opportunities, not just to come in here and worship, but to foster relationships before service, after service, come early and stay late, volunteer for things, look for people who seem to be at the margins. You know, most of us probably interact with the same few people all the time. Look for people who maybe you don't interact with, and try and get to know people's stories. Get to know people who normally you might not otherwise interact with. You know, again, be intentional about that. One of the things that we have done as a church to try and foster this is we have these photo directories that we put out every once in a while. And they, a lot of us have our pictures and so forth in here. And if you're a regular attender at all, we would love to have you contact Nancy about getting your picture in. But it lists the names of people. There's contact information to really provide an opportunity for ways to connect. And Nancy just printed, I think, 70 of them this week. So they're out in the back if you want to grab one on the way out. So that's one of the ways we can really work on that. The next thing, I think, is that beyond corporate worship, there's other opportunities as well. Small groups really provide a chance to grow deeper with other people. You know, I have a small group that I'm involved with, and those people are my family. I mean, I share life with them, and I love being around them on a weekly basis. You know, we push even deeper into relationship than we do here in this setting. And if you're in a small group, I would challenge you to look for ways in which you can invite other people in and grow your small groups. And then if you're not in a small group, go talk to Nancy in the office, or talk to Pastor Dave, talk to Rob, talk to Mike. We want to see people getting connected more deeply. And then again, throughout the year, there's a lot of things that we do that really work to foster relationship. Camp Forest Springs is this fall conference that we do. Next weekend is this fall bash where you have a chance to come in, bring people along where we can really grow in relationship. The Edge, and I have to mention the Edge Connection, which is this thing where the Edgers come to a person's house and have a meal and they hang out. And it's at our house this week. Is it Friday night? Any of the Edgers know? Friday night at our house. And if you have questions about it, just, again, ask. We want to see people coming and interacting with one another. We want to see people growing in relationships with one another here and outside these walls. So to bring us back full circle, again, John 13, 34 and 35 says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, you also are to love one another. And by this, all people will know that you're my disciples, if you have love for one another." So as you leave here today, be asking yourself, how can I move toward others in such a way that it demonstrates the love of Christ? Let's pray. Father, thank you for this chance to be here today. I thank you for the opportunity to talk about your word and to talk about people. God, I thank you that you issue us challenges. God, you lived a perfect life, and we have the chance to just see from your life how relationships can work. And I pray that you would challenge each of us to go from here this day and think about how we can push deeper, move toward others in relationship. And I pray this now in your name. Amen.